The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And still here in gorgeous, beautiful Moselle at a smaller winery, a gorgeous one. I'm here with the winemaker and owner of Axel Pauli. It is Axel Pauli. Axel, thank you so much for being a part of the podcast.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I'm going to start in a completely different direction. Your winery is the first one I've been to in Germany where there's a trampoline right next to it. Explain to people a little bit about where we are and how far your commute to work is.
Yeah, we are inside the winery, and it's a smaller winery, and we also live in the place. So we have everything next by. We're living here, we have the office here, we have the cellar here, we have the production here. So it's a 10-hectare big estate, so very, very small. But for Mosel, it's quite a big estate because the vineyards here are so steep and so much work. So most of the wineries have 3, 4, 5 hectares.
Mm-hmm. So you have 10. And I know this is a bad podcast because I'm not going to talk visual. But are the vines to our right that we're in the tasting room here at Axel Pauli? It's gorgeous. Are these vines? How many of these represent your production?
So we can look at our vineyards, mm-hmm. but the Mosel is very small structured, mm-hmm. even smaller structured like Burgundy. We look at maybe 20 different producers. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's a vineyard is only 500 square meter big. Some of the vineyards are 2,000 square meter big. So you look at maybe 50 different vineyards. And 20 of them are from us. So we have 10 hectares and 74 different vineyards. From Lieserer Schlossberg to Lieserer Niederberg-Helden and to Berncastle Coos.
Right. That's for people listening, if you're in Ontario, think of a small bunny slope in Ontario for skiing. And yet it makes up 50 different producers source grapes from that area. What is the most annoying Sunday day off have you had? Because you mentioned it before we started, where you were barbecuing or playing with your kids and someone walked up to you and wanted to buy Riesling.
It's nice to live inside a winery because you're always in the middle of the work and you can react on things directly, especially in harvest time when you have to stop fermentation, control fermentation. Sometimes I stand up, I go up early at 2 or 3 o'clock and I'm directly in the cellar. Mm-hmm. But, of course, there are some disadvantages. And that's when we have a Sunday and playing with the kids and then a customer comes by and wants to buy wine.
Yeah.
But we're living from...
Of course.
Selling wine.
Of
so
course.
It's not a big problem.
I have to say, I would be so tempted because where we are, I look to my right and I see the beautiful Moselle vineyards. I look to my left and I see family homes. I'm not going to lie. I'd be tempted on a Sunday just in flip-flops coming, walking over and asking for a bottle of wine. I'd love to hear just a little bit more about the vineyard, about when you got started here. I'd love to hear a little bit more about the start of your journey.
So the journey of the winery begins with my grandfather. Mm-hmm. He was a fisherman fishing in the Mosel, and the vineyards had been only a side project. Mm-hmm. It's like every family had vineyards here in Mosel. And then he concentrated on winemaking and started the winery. My father did take over the winery, and in... 2006, I came home from studies, and in 2009, my father gave me quite early the winery.
What were you studying?
Winemaking.
Okay, so what were I wasn't sure if you were, I've talked to other winemakers where they were studying law or other things and then eventually went into it. Okay, you said early. How old were you when your father said, Axel, you're taking over now?
29.
29?
Yeah.
Is that feels young? Was that like in this area, would you say you were one of the younger winemakers at that time?
Yeah, because most of the family wineries, the fathers, or they have problems to handle over their mm-hmm. their winery.
Right.
So they normally do that maybe with when they're 65 or 70 or sometimes when they're 80.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
So I'm quite happy that my father did it that early.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked in 2004. We worked together in the cellar. And it happened that I pumped white wine in a tank, and 2 hours later he pumped the red wine in the same tank.
Oh no! Yeah. You made rosé.
And then afterwards we had a big louder discussion, and then he said, "Okay, two chefs.
Yeah,
I'm not working."
Right.
So and then he gave me handled me over the cellar work, but. Is doing all the controlling, so he checks mm-hmm. quality and is tasting the wines before we're bottling and so on.
Now I want to go off on a tangent. Who decides when to pick?
That's my my job.
So that is on you.
Yeah.
The accidental rosé that you made. What did you do with it? Did you throw it out? Did you throw it in a bottle out of a lark, or was it just drained out and considered a happy mistake?
No, there is a, we bottled it and drank it mostly by ourselves.
Okay, so you didn't throw a label on it and market it as father and son made German rosé. I want to go back to your grandfather for a second. I read this quote. Steep slope wine growers are heroes. I read that quote that your grandfather said. How heroic is it being a wine grower and a wine picker in this area?
Yeah, you have to go into the vineyard, maybe after the interview,
mm-hmm.
and then you will feel it. Of course, it's a lot of work. And it's much more work to have a vineyard in steep slopes than in flat slopes. It's just every meter you look in front of you and say, okay, now next step. It's not only a next step.
Mm-hmm.
It's you will, you're climbing, actually. And in a very hot summertime, and then you have the sun, and then the vineyards are like an amphitheater towards the sun in the Lisera Niederberghelden. You have no shadow.
Mm-hmm.
Then the slate is heating up, and like your shoes are burning. And that's really, really hot.
I just saw a couple of people on bicycles just going down the road to my left. How different is the temperature for them on that bike versus on the middle of the vineyard in the middle of the day? Like how different is the temperature?
It's much hotter.
Mm-hmm.
It depends. When the wind is blowing, then it's okay.
Yeah.
But if there's no wind and the heat just stays,
mm-hmm.
it's really like you're in an oven.
Right.
In the middle of an oven, yeah.
And yeah, we were touring yesterday and you can feel the slate just, especially like 12, 1 o'clock, how warm it is.
Yeah.
How many pairs of shoes do how many pairs of shoes and boots does someone go through in a given harvest?
Yeah, but what we do is in summertime, if it becomes really hot, we start at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning,
right?
And then we stop at around 11
mm-hmm.
because afterwards it's not possible to work anymore. Yeah.
And at this time, and this next question, just for people that are interested in the winemaking part of it, we're sort of many months away from harvest. And we're just waiting for the bud break and all that. What goes on in the vineyards on a day like today?
It's we had rain before, then we have very sunny days now, so it's growing very fast.
Mm-hmm.
And we have we call it aufbinden. We have to fix the shoots that they're not break when the wind is coming. Then we have to remove some leaves from the stems so that they are clean then, and in 1 or 2 weeks the flowering will start,
mm-hmm.
and then we have to remove the leaves that are next to the to the berries or to the grape, that the if there's rain, that they can dry very fast, just to do some leaf work now.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And now is maybe the most, instead of the harvest, the most work intensive time of the year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't even think about that. I was wondering if we could talk about the first wine that you poured for us.
Yeah, it's called Purist.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Riesling, and the name says it all.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very dry Riesling.
Mm-hmm.
It only has 1 gram of sugar,
mm-hmm.
and only 11 alcohol. So very light, very pure and light. So the idea of the wine is, how tastes Riesling with no makeup?
Mm-hmm.
No sugar that makes it fruity, not much alcohol to make it round. So just the pure grape taste and the minerality of the wine.
And when did you start with Purist? How long has this been in the family? Is this a newer wine?
No, normally it's more tradition in the Mosel that you balance the acid with some sugar.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the dry wines have 6, 7, 8 grams of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
So you rarely find wines that are 1 gram or absolutely pure. It became by accident.
Oh,
we
yeah.
14 years ago, we had a wine that was that dry, and we tried to blend it with a sweeter wine to give it that 6, 7 gram.
Right.
And every time we did it, we found that the original wine was better.
Mm-hmm.
It had more personality. It was just purer.
Huh.
We tried it many, many times, and then my father said, "And let's bottle it like it is." And I think about it. And at night, I thought about it, and then I take my notes, and then I always write very pure, very like fountain water and so on. And then I came up with the idea, let's name it Purist. And actually, this is not from the volumes of bottles, our most important wine, but from image.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we did the wine, we became an article at the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, one of the most recognizable or most important magazines in Germany. And the next day we had like 1,000 customers who wanted to order the wine.
Really?
And so that was a start.
Nice.
And also it was a start that there's a young winemaker who does things a little bit different.
It's a great story.
Or modern,
right.
and that was the idea of the wine, and it's still today. It's not that a lot of you have to have some wine experience. You have to be a Riesling lover to understand the wine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a wine for everyone.
Yeah,
but sommeliers they really love the wine, and we sell it to a lot to star restaurants and so on.
Mm-hmm.
They normally open up a menu with the wine. So that's the first wine for the first course to rinse the palate, to refresh, maybe some oyster with, and then because you can't start a menu with the Corsica Vex, for example.
No.
It's a small wine, it's a light wine, and that's the reason for it.
So yeah, it's very versatile. And you're right. You're probably not gonna start the night with something big and heavy if you're there for a full night, especially at like a star restaurant. You mentioned before, you were talking about how you were lying in bed and you were making your notes. How many parts of the day are you not thinking about wine? I mean, especially because you live here. Do you sometimes find it difficult to sort of shut off the wine part?
That's the time when I drink beer.
Mm-hmm.
No, sometimes you have to. You just have to relax your head.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just not 24 hours a day think about wine.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather said once to me, if you only know things about wine, you know nothing.
Right.
So you have to sometimes read books and think of other things. And
yeah.
And sometimes that also influence you, and you came up with a new idea with wine. That doesn't happen if you only think mm-hmm. about wine.
Yeah, so, yeah. It's the what I like to think of as the unintended consequences in life. When you start reading or something else, and then, you know, it somehow filters its way back into the wine. Actually, I'm curious because you mentioned your father and your adventures with him and your grandfather. How cool is it seeing your name on the bottle or seeing people enjoying something that's just tied in, not just to you, but to generations and generations of your family?
Yeah, then I have to mention the label, because the label is very important for us. The label shows the Mosel region, yep, with the steep vineyard and a curvy river, so our landscape. If you turn the bottle, you see three-phase profiles, and it's my grandfather, my father, and me, so three generations.
Oh, that is, you're right. That is like some super cool optical illusion.
Yeah.
And there you are on the bottle. That's fantastic.
So because we think of wine that wine should have a regional identity. Mm-hmm. So the wine should be influenced by the weather, the slate, the region, what is the given nature thinks. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, it's the people who produce the wines.
Right.
It's the winemaker who harvests the grapes and who decide when how the wine actually tastes. So a wine always has the influence of the nature and the people who produce it. And this is the story of the label.
That is a super cool label. I was wondering, would it be possible, I have a lot of other questions to ask you. I was wondering if it was possible to try anything else from the portfolio, only anything you have open. I don't want you opening anything that's supposed to be saved. And we're back with the second one. And by the way, so I want to say, I not only appreciate the time, but I always appreciate when any of the winemakers or owners, when they pour anything from their portfolio. You know, so I just want to say I appreciate.
Yeah. So
what do we have now?
We have a Weißburgunder, Pinot Blanc. I think that is, beside Riesling, becoming the second important grape variety of the Mosel Valley, because it is a very elegant grape. It is quite neutral in taste, it is a little bit softer in acid. Mm-hmm. And I think it is a nice alternative to Riesling.
So then, you kind of answered. I was going to ask you just what are the major differences, but then so a little less acid, a little bit more neutral, and probably a little bit maybe more approachable to people that aren't ready to get into the sometimes very large profile of a Riesling wine.
Yeah.
And when did you has this been a part of the family? How long have you been doing Pinot Blanc?
No, it's quite new. We planted our first vineyard in 2005. Mm-hmm. So. It's not very nice fruit wine, and we have 30% of oak, so it was fermented in oak, 30%, and that gives the wine some balance and some backbone. But compared to other more hotter regions in Germany, it's still crisp and light and fresh. So very precise. Yeah, it's a little bit like the purist of a Weißburgunder, I would call it.
I saw this quote of yours saying, "I want to offer people wines with identity, typical of the Moselle, shaped by my experiences and the confrontation with my own tradition." So a couple bits of that quote I want to go through. What do you think is the identity of this winery?
Actually, I have to say that when I was becoming a winemaker, I learned in Pfalz region, in Rheingau region. I was working in California. I was working in New Zealand. And when I have taken over the winery and made my first wines, the wines were a little bit more international, a little bit more rounder, a little bit more alcohol, a little bit more easy drinking in a way.
Trying to appease to markets across the world.
A little bit.
Yeah.
And then my grandfather said to me, "Well, nice wines, but you have to make Mosel wines." And he was absolutely right. I mean, why should I make in the most beautiful and one of the best places to make Riesling, or maybe the best place to make Riesling, why should I do international wines?
Right.
You have to concentrate on the strength of your region. And that is with low alcohol, we can produce a lot of taste in the wine. So the wines, they don't need to be 13 or 14 alcohol. We can produce with 11 or 12 alcohol, we can produce very amazing wines. And Riesling, they need acid. So low alcohol, an acid that is more a dancing, refreshing acid, and then on the other side, a pureness and freshness in the wines. That is, so we work with output writers to have more clearliness, mm-hmm. purity in the wines. That's the identity of, or the style of our winery.
What was it like working in California or New Zealand? What did you learn from those regions, or what were your main impressions?
Of course, everything was a little bit more easygoing. Mm-hmm. Here in Mosul, it is a lot of tradition, and everything is taken very serious. And there it was, let's try this and let's try this. It was a little bit more innovative, a little bit more easy to do new things, not to think a lot about tradition and the lifestyle also that you more enjoyed to be a winemaker. And here it is, sometimes it's a lot of pressure on you. And mm-hmm. there it was, have a barbecue and then we do the next pump over. And so it was a little bit hearing rock music the whole day. And so
right.
that was nice.
Do you feel more pressure because not only is your family name on the label, but your face is on the label as well, and you're carrying on that tradition? I wonder, versus people in the new world where maybe they're the first generation of winemakers, and you know there's so much more expanding new wine territories in the new world versus here, where we're looking at vines that have been here for 300, 400, 500 years old. Do you think there might be more pressure on you than someone in Sonoma?
I don't know. Could be, but I think every winemaker, or that is my every winemaker I learned to know, he wants to do good wines. Mm-hmm. So I'm never happy with a bad wine.
Yeah. Yeah,
so I couldn't bottle it. So I don't know if it's together with the label, but I want to produce very good wines that I like myself. So that's the pressure I have.
Okay, yeah, no, that's fair. Do you have a memory of the happiest and the saddest you've ever been in terms of just a great vintage and a bad vintage? You just said, I'm never happy with a bad wine. I'm wondering, is there a moment that sticks out where, you know, either just because suddenly the hail hit or something? Was there one year of vintage that really upset you? And then the other end, one vintage where everything was just singing?
Yeah, we had 2 years we had hail, and that's always a big, a very sad thing, because you put so much work into the vineyards, and then just a few weeks before the harvest, hail comes and destroys everything, or nearly everything. And in the beginning, it normally looks very, very, very awful and very hard to see, and you feel with the grapes. But normally then, if it's 2 or 3 weeks later, you can see how the nature repairs mm-hmm. things. So then it looks quite, and then you say, oh yeah, maybe we can do something out of it.
Right.
But the first reaction is like everything is destroyed. Everything is like, and then it could be that I'm 2 days or 3 days in bed and I can't move, because
yeah.
You feel what happened. And then in harvest, it's always, if you can harvest healthy grapes, that motivates, of course. Then you earn what you work the whole year, and then you have it finally in your bucket or in the press, and that's a nice feeling.
It must be on both ends, because, you know, you mentioned the first part with the hail. It's like we've worked for months and months and months, and we've been there in the hot sun, and my boots got melted, and then suddenly one day of hail, it's like, oh, so you've just ruined.
Yeah, it's 5 minutes.
Yeah, And then the other end, you know, when you bring it in and you start to, you know, you start tasting it and it's working out so well, it's like, this is, you know, the fruit of my reward. And I think I screwed up that expression. But, you know, just that moment of joy, knowing all those months are paying off.
That's, and sometimes also, here in the tasting room. Mm-hmm. If I have customers and I can see that they really enjoy the wine,
yeah,
then it's also a very nice feeling. Or sometimes at fair, we just had 2 weeks ago, we had the ProWein, and there are normally only professionals, and they say if it's good or not.
Yeah.
And if the reaction there is only positive, that's also a nice feeling then. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, the first two, by the way, have been fantastic. That's a really good Pinot Blanc, and I imagine this one as well, much like your purists, could be used very early on in a dinner. It could be used for similar thing. The purists and the Pinot Blanc could be used for very similar purposes when it comes to food pairing. Mm-hmm. Love to hear about 2000 and by the way, if you want to grab another wine and then we'll I want to hear about 2011. And we're back, and now we're trying, this is your Reserve Pinot Blanc 2019. And I think you were saying this one spends a little bit of time on oak.
Yeah, it's actually on new oak.
Mm-hmm.
For 2 years.
Really?
Yeah.
How many producers here do white with 2 years of new oak? You are the first that I've heard of that.
Maybe two or three. It's Marcos Molitor, I know, mm-hmm. who does Reserve of his Pinot Blanc. Mm-hmm. And
he does a Chardonnay as well, so
yeah,
because I don't know.
Yeah, but we decided to concentrate to focus on Pinot Blanc. There are some of the producers are going for Pinot Gris. Mm-hmm. Grauburgunder is selling a lot here in Germany, but I think Weißburgunder fits better to our region because it's more elegant. Mm-hmm. And then I also had the chance maybe to plant Chardonnay, but you have Burgundy and...
Right.
Why to compete with them? So
yeah.
I decided, let's concentrate on Pinot Blanc, and I think you can get very good results on it. And we did get from Robert Parker 93 points mm-hmm. for this.
Congrats! By the way, it's lovely. And
yeah.
And I've talked about this with some other grapes, but this is for the person that only drinks Chardonnay, but maybe wants to expand their portfolio and try different stuff, this wine would be a perfect landing spot for someone.
Yeah.
No, it's lovely. So I mentioned it before, 2011. What happened to the winery?
In 2011 we had a fire in the winery, and everything burned down instead of the cellar. And that was, for our winery, of course, a big thing, and everything changed from then. And on the other side, it was a start of a lot of things. So afterwards, we had to
improvisation.
Yeah, we had to improvise a lot of things because we had no roof. We had to make the pressing outside of the winery. We could rent another winery in the town.
Mm-hmm.
And then we wanted to rebuild the winery. But I said, let's take some time and get some ideas. So we traveled to other regions, looking at newer wineries. We decided, okay, now we have some ideas. We saw how other winemakers did it, and then we planned a new winery. And 2 years after the fire, we had a new production hall, and then we could rebuild the old winery, but in a more modern style.
How difficult was that? Just, you mentioned the improvisation of it. How difficult was it? So for a couple of years, you're still here making wine. You're still trying to maintain that same level of quality. But you're hamstrung because all your normal, the normal process has been hampered so much.
Yeah, it was really hard years, of course. Mm-hmm. But on the other side, you had a lot of pressure, and sometimes that helps to improve quality.
Right.
If you're saying, okay, we have to build something new, I have to invest And so I have to find new customers, I have to improve the quality. And so it was a lot of pressure, and that helped maybe to be more consequent, more working more precisely, mm-hmm. and so on. Yeah.
So sort of it forces you to adapt and forces you to improve. You don't want to be forced to do it, but then when you're, I mean, good on you for when the opportunity struck, you know, by very, you know, negative way, at the very least, you were able to turn it eventually into a positive. Where we are right now is gorgeous. And your tasting room and everything here, it definitely looks different than most of the ones we've been to so far in Germany.
Yeah, the idea was a little bit with the purist, to have a very clean building, a very clear structure. And then on the other side, I wanted to work, like the label also has the regional things. We wanted to work with the with slate on the outside, what is in the vineyards, slate in the inside, oak on the table, and so on. So with the natural things we have here, and the tasting room should look modern, but not cool. It should have a warm impression,
right?
That the customer seeing, okay, we're normal winemaker, we're normal people, we're just concentrating on wine, and not that sometimes it looks more like a temple or something. You're going to, everything is white, and there comes the winemaker. So here, just sit on the table.
Yeah.
Drink a good wine, and that's it.
Yeah, so not some giant cathedral, with like, ancient Greek and Roman gods representing wine and passion. Actually, one thing about this place that makes it feel, as you mentioned, a little bit warmer, are all the windows. Like, as we're sitting here, I'm watching families walking by and on their bicycles. But then on the other side, I'm reminded of where all the grapes come from. Like, just having all these windows open, it does create this very comfortable, sort of environment.
Yeah.
So, and you were saying before, what were you doing with some of your red wine during that fire in 2011? You were, because earlier you said that you and your father, by mistake, created rosé, and then suddenly you decided maybe you wanted to make some sort of Amarone.
Yeah, but that happened by accident, by the fire. There was in the rooms where the fire started, there were my barrique barrels from the Pinot Noir 2010 vintage. Mm-hmm. And of course, Pinot Noir here in Mosel means a lot of work. You have to lower the crop, and so a lot of handwork. And I love Pinot Noir, so it's a lot of passion for the Pinot Noir. So I saw after the fire, the barrels, and they were completely black. Mm-hmm. But I thought maybe in the inside is some wine inside that is maybe drinkable.
Yeah.
So the fireworks were still working, and the smoke was already there. But I started to taste the barrels, and then because it was only half of the wine left,
right?
The other half burned or cooked. And I thought maybe it's like a concentration, like an Amarone. And I tasted the wines, but it was tasting awful because there were the
plastic bung.
The plastic bung, they were, burnt and tripped into the wine, and it was just tasting like plastic.
Yeah, I don't think you can fix that. I know sometimes there's chemicals you can use for smoke taint. I've seen this in California with fires in the vineyards.
Mm.
I don't think there's any sort of chemical that could have gotten rid of that plastic.
No. That was just, we had to dump it, unfortunately.
Well, and by the way, like, we were having fun with this, and the fire certainly led to where we're sitting now, but was everyone okay? There was...
Yeah, that was a good part.
Okay.
Nothing hurt.
Yeah.
It was just the building that was burned, and then things that inside, and that was... And that's something, then you can do from something negative, you can do something positive out of it. If not personal, somebody had been hurt. Yeah.
Would it be all right to try one of your Rieslings?
Yeah.
Thank you. And we're back, and now we're trying one of the Pauli Rieslings. Axel, what are we drinking here, sir?
We have a wine that just bottled 2 weeks ago. It's called the Helden Riesling. It's coming from the Lieserer Niederberg Helden, the steepest part of here of the vineyards in Lieser. It's 60-year-old wines. It's 70% steep. So the roots are very long. Sometimes they can be 10 meters long. So very much bounded to the soil, to the slate. And the wine has 12.5 alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a very alcoholic wine, but you have a lot of power inside.
You
a
do.
Lot of ingredients, a lot
it's
of...
It's meaty. It is a meaty, savory Riesling.
Yeah, it is bouncing mm-hmm. from the inside, the minerality, and you can see the quality of the grapes.
And just so much of that just comes from the exact spot where the grapes are from, obviously, but just having it at the steepest, you know, it means... And again, I'm asking this, but I'd love for you to... Actually, you know what? Explain to the listeners why the steeper the slope can produce the better the Riesling.
I mean, there are a lot of things you have to consider.
Mm-hmm.
We are a very cool region, and normally we need this every hint of sun. And in the best vineyards, the south-facing, they get a lot of sun. And then the steeper they are, the more sun they even get there. They're sitting... The vines are sitting like in a stadium, mm-hmm. so they can look towards the sun from every place they are. So, and then very important is the slate that gives them the minerality to the wines, and also heats up and can, like a battery, get the sun
mm-hmm.
make the place more warmer. And when the Romans over 2,000 years here came to this valley, they founded Trier, the northern capital of their empire. So they wanted to drink wine.
Of course.
And actually a soldier had been, it was by law that he could drink over 1 liter per day.
That would not make for a very good army.
Yeah.
I feel your battle skills... You know, once you hit a liter, your ability with a sword or a bow and arrow takes a hit.
Yeah. But the wines had been lower in alcohol.
Oh, that's true.
And they mixed it with water.
Right.
But so they needed wine.
Right.
And then they see, it's very cool place, northern place. Where can we get wine?
Mm-hmm.
So then they saw the south-facing vineyards. And there they started to grow wine. And then they found out, it's possible. And in all the famous vineyards nowadays, like the Piesbotter Goldtröpfchen, the Braunberger Jofasonnenuhr, the Lieserer Niederberghelden, the Erdener Tröpfchen,
mm-hmm.
they found old Roman press stations.
Really?
So
ah.
they didn't know where the best vineyards are 2,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is fascinating, that we are working in places where the Romans had already worked 2,000 years before and produced wine.
That's wild.
And that they, I mean, all the best vineyard places, the famous names you know nowadays, mm-hmm. you found the old press station, and that means that they produced wine there. That is, I think that's very fascinating.
It is, and it also kind of explains why this is the best area for Riesling. And it's not that other areas don't make great Riesling. I love Rieslings from Clarendon Valley, Ontario makes some great wines, Finger Lakes, but you guys have been here the longest, you know, just and thousands of years of people knowing exactly if we plant here, we're going to get the best quality. I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, people come to this land to try these wines is just because of your history of it.
Yeah.
Also, I feel that that it's a good thing that they were drinking Moselle Riesling before fighting. Like, if it was like a Sonoma Chardonnay, I feel like there would be a lot more napping and a lot less stabbing just because, you know, that higher alcohol is gonna put you to sleep. You talked about, I was mentioning about Rieslings. I'm always curious about this, especially for someone like yourself that's a little bit younger. Are there other Rieslings from other parts of the world that you try, that you enjoy, that, I don't know, influence you? I'm always curious, what do winemakers drink when they're not drinking their wine?
Everywhere I travel, every winemaker asks me for a sweet cabinet. Because that's a wine style, sweet cabinet, that can't be produced in other places in the world.
Yeah.
And a lot of winemakers all over the world, in Sonoma, in Napa, in New Zealand, they love to drink after the work when the press is running, and or when they're cleaning the press at 1 o'clock in the night, they love to drink a cabinet from Mosel Valley, because it's a unique wine style that you can't find in any other place than in Mosel. What I like to drink personal is every wine, actually. I really like wines from other regions, just to give it a try, just what is special about the region, what makes the grape variety so special with the soil. But it is in red wine, it is Pinot Noir, Nebbiolo from the Barolo area, and the Northern Rhone. So things are regions that are also about terroir and vineyards and so on. And in white wine, I think Grüne Veltliner and Silvaner are also very nice grape varieties.
We were just in Austria and Vienna right before this trip, so we certainly got to try a bunch of those. Axel, I really appreciate it. As we end this, tell people listening, because why they should come and visit, why they should visit you, and why they should not be afraid of German Riesling.
Can't be afraid of German Riesling.
They're not worried. They're like, oh, it's too sweet. And when I was a kid, I got drunk on Black Tower and all this other BS.
But it was nice, maybe.
Well, when you're 17, it's nice, you know.
No. I think there is a higher quality than you maybe expect. The wine scene is much more modern than you maybe expect. It's not old winemakers lying under the cask or monks. So it's a very a young generation that's innovative, and I think you can have wines with low alcohol that are very good with modern cuisine, with northern cuisine. And I think I think the quality level is very high on German wines. And it's wines that you can drink a bottle and you're still fine.
Yes.
And that's the difference to Chardonnays with 15% alcohol.
Yeah. Well, listen, Axel, I really appreciate the time. I love your story. I love the label and the wines we tried. You're right. And there is just a very clean purity to everything that we've done, that we've tried today. And I wish you nothing but success going forward. You know, you're certainly an example of someone that, you know, was hit hard back a little over a decade ago and bounced back brilliantly, and wish you nothing but success going forward.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.